Welcome to a podcast of How Open Licensing Improved Our Textbook and Our Careers, presented by Barbara Ilowski, Professor of Mathematics and Statistics at De Anza Community College and co-author of Collaborative Statistics. This podcast was recorded at the 2010 Text and Academic Authors Association Conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota. TAA is the only nonprofit membership association dedicated solely to assisting textbook and academic authors to enhance the quality of textbooks and other academic materials by providing them with educational and networking opportunities. For more information about TAA, go to http://www.taaonline.net.
I'm going to get started. Hi, I'm Barbara Ilowski, and I want to welcome you. And I'm here to talk to you about open educational resources and open licensing, which my understanding is that most people know very little about. Do any of you have experience with OER? No. Good. Last night when I met Paul Rosenzweig, who's on the council or board here, he told me that I was coming to be thrown into the wolves, but I like talking in front of men and you look really friendly, so I'm just going to hope that that's not the case on here. So what I thought I would do is at least go over a little bit about what open educational resources are, and I figured I would take a pulse, and if you felt that you already knew all this, then I would just go through it really quickly. But basically, OER are not just stuff on the web. There's lots of stuff on the web, but these are generally considered to be high-quality items that are on the web. Probably the most common one is Wikipedia that people have heard of, and there are a lot of items on the web that are not high-quality, but they tend to be quality items that have been peer-reviewed to some level. They are shareable, meaning that you can use them, you can share them, you can reuse them, you can, depending upon the type of license, which I'll go over a little bit, you can modify them, you can adapt them to how you want to have them. And I have a whole bunch of different symbols that are copyright symbols up there that relate to copyright and open licensing. Open textbooks are textbooks that tend to have a Creative Commons license, and the Creative Commons license is a license so that the author or the publisher, depending upon who it is, still owns the copyright, but the license allows people certain privileges, just like a regular license. And an open textbook license, there are several different levels of Creative Commons ones. This allows people to some to reprint, some to review, some to just view on the web, but it allows you to do certain tasks with the textbook without having to pay a royalty. And so if you have a typical copyright, you need to pay a royalty. When you want to reprint, for example, there are little ways of getting around based on the Fair Use Act. So if you put something on reserve for one semester at the library, very often you don't need to pay a royalty, but yet if you want to reprint for your class, you do. And open licensing allows that to happen without having to pay the royalty on there. So here are the different types of rights that are typically allowed, and I wanted to just show you the different types of Creative Commons licenses. Larry Lessig, who is the person who was the founder of Creative Commons, is from Stanford University, and that's where the Creative Commons licensing got going. But many people also know about OpenCourseWare and Open Textbooks from MIT's program, the OpenCourseWare. That program typically doesn't have open textbooks, but faculty members put up notes and course materials on the website that are open to all. Is it your wife who has open works at Yale? Was that? Okay, so the Yale Open One. Tufts Medical School has a lot of programs that are open. Carnegie Mellon University has a Carnegie Mellon Initiative, which is my textbook, which I'll be just talking about a little bit, is at Rice University. They have a large project called the Connections Project. These are different types of Creative Commons licenses. The one that I have is the most lenient, meaning that anybody can download it, reuse it, edit it, and repost it, adding their own name to it. But what they do need to do is they need to give attribution to myself and my colleague as original authors. There are some, the top one, for example, where you cannot make a profit off of it. We thought about that because the first thing is like, why should somebody else make a profit if I'm not making a profit? But what the profit part allows is my own campus print shop to reprint for students, or the bookstore to sell the packet and have their markup on there. If we put the no profit on there, then unless we did a specific license with our camp, with our college, they wouldn't be able to print. So here's the textbook that I'm co-author of with Susan Dean. And it actually, there's an even previous iteration of it. It was originally textbook by, signed on with HarperCollins when they had their college division in the early 90s. And so it was sold. We had a royalty contract. HarperCollins sold their entire textbook, college textbook division to Addison Wesley. And so Addison Wesley then had the copyright. And then in the mid-90s, Addison Wesley, and I'm not sure which order it was, whether they bought Prentice Hall or Prentice Hall bought them, but there was huge merging of textbook companies. And Susan and I actually purchased the copyright back from Addison Wesley. They went from HarperCollins only having two college statistics books to Addison Wesley, Prentice Hall, whatever the large collaboration was, of having over a dozen. And so we asked if we could purchase the copyright back, and we did on there. So then, for the next decade, we self-published the book and earned money for that. One of the big advantages to self-publishing is that you earn a lot of money per book. One of the disadvantages is the distribution network you don't have. And so we sold a lot fewer than had we been with the traditional publishing. We only spoke at the conferences we wanted to go to, which was an advantage. On the other hand, people didn't know us, and most of the conferences we were in request that that if you're speaking and you're an author, you're not speaking promoting your textbook. But we were happy with it, and it was being used. We were selling about anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 copies a year, and we had no middleman, per se. The storage was at my garage, and it worked. At our college and other colleges, the bookstores were selling the book for $50, and so there's reasonable profit all around. Now, it's an open textbook, and I'll go over that a little bit. If you want to, Connections is part of Rice University, and COOP is a separate organization where they have a relationship with, and so when people purchase the hard copy, a little bit of royalties goes back to Rice University on that part. You can download the book for free. It's in PDF format. You can download page by page for free, or you can print it out, although it's 600 pages. It's costs less for students to buy the printed version than it does to print out on their own. And I've only had one student who actually printed out the entire book, and she did it at work. So typically, it's a lot less expensive to purchase it hard copy if you want to. I wanted to just go through and show you a little bit of what it looks online. Again, I'm not promoting my book. It's just this is the one how I know how to show how it looks online. This is the Connections format. So all the textbooks that are in Connections, which is part of Rice University, are in this typical format. You'll notice that it has hyperlinks involved in it. The left column, the table of contents, are all links that go to the various chapters in there. Students can download and print it if they want, or just download the PDF. And I have a lot of students who bring their laptops to college and to the classroom. And I encourage them not to purchase the hard copy. I say, don't use it. Just download it. Some students have it in programs where they can actually do the highlighting on top of the program, and then they can save it and save their notes. They can print out just the homework if they want instead of printing out the whole thing. There's the online version, and they could also order the hard copy. Our bookstore every year buys dozens of them and sells them in the bookstore for actually less than, and it buys it from Coop, but they could also print them on their own if they wanted to. So this is just an example of the first chapter. You can see on the left side, you can go to any section that you want, including the homework or including the labs. You can navigate this way. And what I like about using an online book, and I'm not of the generation that grew up online, what I like about using the online book is you can see under frequency there, that's a hyperlink. And so one of the advantages that I actually didn't know about until after I was showing somebody the online text, and this was a reading specialist, is she said it's actually better from a reading standpoint for students who have difficulty in learning and in reading, and English second language students, because the hyperlink will pop up to the glossary right away. And so the students don't need to flip to the back of the book, which they will almost never do to look up words. They can just link through to them. So I thought first I would, I had no idea how many people to expect, but I thought there would be more. But I did think about, people often tell me there's no way I would write a book for free, or I would publish anything of mine on the web for free because I worked so hard to write whatever I did. But I was wondering if any of you have published articles before in journals. Forget about textbook, yes? Okay, so why did you publish your first article?
I would say that's what we do in science. I'm a scientist.
Okay.
Get the word out and establish yourself.
Okay, and did you get paid for it?
No.
And did you publish a second article after that? Okay, how about yourself?
It cost me money.
Cost you money?
No, I didn't have to pay a journal. I have to buy the photographs for it. But in my life,
okay, so I'm just going to repeat because of this.
I get a demerit for writing the text.
Okay, so what's your field?
Well, it's less what my field is than where I work.
Okay, can you say that?
Yeah, I'm at Boston University.
Okay, so at Boston University, you get demerits for textbooks, but you continue to write because that's what's required in the academic field. And it may cost you or your department or your budget money to buy the photographs, to do other things. In the meantime, if you're writing, you're not doing at the same time. That time is going for free writing, and even for people who are writing and maybe getting a stipend, you're not doing extra consulting during that time. So in essence, it could be considered costing money to write. Right? No, I'm not talking about textbook. I'm talking just about articles.
Yeah, okay.
Establishing yourself, writing an article. How about yourself?
I didn't write an article, so I wouldn't have a job at all.
Okay, so you write an article because you have to.
Yes.
Right. I don't know anybody who's received tenure at a major university without having written. Right. And yourself? Okay, so writing to establish yourself for credibility in the field, and so on. Yeah. How about writing that wasn't professionally related? Do you ever submit a letter to the editor or something else that you wrote? You did, and why?
Well, I've submitted a number of letters to the editor because I wanted to voice a minority opinion that I felt like the media wasn't covering. And I've also written articles for non-academic magazines. Basically, because I love writing and wasn't doing any other writing at the time, and had some things I wanted to say.
Okay, so you wrote for non-academic magazines, which I'm assuming you weren't paid $10,000 for, so.
I paid enough to maybe cover my postage.
Right, and letters to the editor, we have a strong opinion and you want to get something out. Okay? And so that's also why I've written journal articles, and for all the reasons that you've stated before. Okay, how about textbook? You've written textbooks? Yes? How come you wrote your very first one? Okay, so you were invited to write a textbook.
Well, I was invited to become the junior author on the consistent textbook.
All right.
And I moved primarily to be able to teach on a national scale.
Okay, so the first thing that you did this for was more credibility to be able to teach on a national scale. I didn't hear you say that the number one reason you wrote it was to get money. But it's a nice benefit.
I would not have done it for nothing the way I write articles.
Okay. But you do write articles for nothing.
Yes.
Okay. And you have a textbook? And how come you wrote your very first one?
The editor came around and asked me to edit because I was teaching in a different way than was traditional.
Okay. So that's pretty similar to what happened to myself also. I had gone through, I teach at a community college, and we have in California, we have a huge English second language population, and we were using a lot of university statistics books, and the students just weren't reading them because they either had so much difficulty, and actually, I must say, it was not our ESL students that had the difficulty in the reading, it was more our native population that were educated in our local K-12 community, which is supposed to be very highly achieving with lots of high success, but it wasn't the books. Susan and I went through a series of textbooks, and they weren't meeting the needs of our students. So we started writing supplements, and then we started writing more supplements, and then we started technology came, and we started integrating the technology, and then as these things evolve, it came into the evolution of a textbook. All right, how about now additional? You have additional textbooks? And so once you did the first one, what made you decide to do additional one?
Must have been insane.
Must have been insane, okay. Did you make money on your first one? Yes, so you knew that there was the money coming down? All right. So the first one you wrote, it sounds more like the money was the secondary. The first one you wrote because you had an alternate teaching style and you wanted to get the word out and establishes credibility. The second one, was it the same reason? Pretty much, yes. How about yourself?
Yeah, I started with supplements, actually. Mm-hmm. Self-publishing supplements, because what I was using wasn't working well. So I started doing that, and enjoyed it so much, and enjoyed the benefits it had for my students, that I decided to write textbooks. And after doing like Fred, I came in on an established...
Yeah, you guys were lucky.
But then after that, almost immediately after that, I then did my textbook on my own. I did it with a co-author, but I basically did all of it.
Okay, so the first one was because you wanted the supplements because it wasn't meeting the needs of your students.
Right.
Okay.
Then I enjoyed the process.
Okay, enjoyed the process.
So then I got into it, not realizing what was all involved. So I think like Fred was hinting at, or actually stated correctly, I wouldn't have done the second one, certainly probably not the first one, without significant
financial benefits, right. So the first time around, and I'm usually speaking to much, much larger groups, but I hear the same things the first time around. I wrote the first one because either something wasn't meeting the needs of my students, or I'd done journal articles, or somebody invited me, or I really liked the way that I thought something should go, and I wanted to do it. Second time around, once you figure out the first time around how much effort it took, and how difficult it was and how time-consuming, the second time around generally tends to be more of a financial consideration. And the third time, is that, would you?
No?
You're the exception, okay.
It's because the first time around I was invited to participate in part one, introductory level, mass
Massive one.
Yeah.
Okay.
The second one I wrote for a small niche market in my own field, and I can kill when I make it back.
Okay, so the second time around, you had... So I'm just repeating this because it's being recorded, and yours wouldn't be, what you said won't come on the mic. So the first time around, you got the money. The second time around, you knew that it wasn't going to make you hundreds of thousands of dollars. You're saying it's almost pro bono. It was for a small niche in your discipline. And so how come you did that?
Well, I wanted to, and because it was a, quote, more serious book on a smaller topic, I actually get credit in a scholarly sense.
Okay, so you got scholarly credit because it was... a high-level book, it had the niche, but it established you, right?
Yeah.
More established, okay. So the whole point of what I'm trying to make, pulling the teeth out here, is that when you ask somebody about why they wrote a textbook, or even a small graduate book, the number one thing that I don't hear. I don't hear the very first thing is, I wanted an easy way to make a lot of money, right? I don't hear that. And if you wanted an easy way to make a lot of money, one thing is we might not go into academia, right? That certainly would have, in my discipline, I would not have gone into academia doing that. Certainly, once I went into academia, teaching overloads wouldn't bring me more money than doing a textbook, especially in the beginning. And once I did that, doing consulting work would even bring more money in. But the textbook did, just like articles, the articles I would say more established, and then the textbooks came in afterwards, and your textbook, you really wanted to get that out, and it was some sort of void in the discipline that you filled in. Okay, good. I just wanted to sort of establish the fact that it's not always exclusively about the funding on here. Here are the benefits I think that you can sort of figure out that for students, the number one benefit, especially students who are financially challenged in going to college. So it may not be the BU students or some of the major universities or the Ivies, but certainly at the community colleges. In California alone, we have 2.7 million community college students. So if they're paying $500 a year in tuition and they're paying $900 to $1,100 a year in textbooks, the textbook is much more of the cost. And if they have a BOG waiver, that Board of Governors waiver, then the textbook is their main cost for that. And so the money saving is how I actually got interested in this. We had the textbook. Sue and I were earning, for us, a considerable amount of money, not in the hundreds of thousands, but in the not in the millions or hundreds of thousands, but earning in the tens of thousands each year as our profit. Never hit over $100,000 a year in profit, but we were still earning, for us, what was a considerable supplemental amount, especially considering that we had split it on that part. And so when we went to the OER part, the students, and already our textbook was very low cost. So at $50 a textbook and close, instead of $130, which is what it was, it was $127 when it was sold by Addison Wesley, the students were already getting a huge break on it. So I went into it with that in mind of the open ed resources. But what I found was the multiple reading formats were really good for student learning, and the hyperlinks were really good for student learning, and also the ADA accessibility, because once they had the files, they were more easily blown up than taking a textbook and just increasing it on the copier. So I just have two types of accessibility that I'm going to talk about. One is the obtaining the book, and here would be the benefits for that. And the other one is ADA compliance accessibility, because that introduces a whole set of problems when a book goes from being printed to going on the web, especially a mathematics or statistics book, which is what I have. So at De Anza, here's what we estimated based on what were previous book sales, and this doesn't include summer session. We went through the student cost savings, based on one academic year at our college. So we run about 30 sections a quarter, so 90 sections an academic year of elementary statistics with 40 students in a class. About 20 of those sections use the textbook that I co-authored. So that's 60 sections a year with 40 students. And a lot of the students get the book used or they get them from a friend, and as they do all places. But we estimated that in the 2008-2009, and I didn't do the estimation, the bookstore figured it out because they were losing a lot of money on this part, what the student savings were just based on going to an OER and having some of the students printing the hard copy. And the students at one community college saved over a quarter of a million dollars on there, which was really substantial when you look at the big picture of how things worked. So here are the benefits that I got. Okay, so I don't want to sound completely altruistic on this part. Susan and I were very lucky. Our book had been in existence for 12, 13 years. It was being used. It wasn't being used as massively as we liked because of the fact that we were self-publishing it at this point. We had great success. Our students transferred to the UCs, CSUs. My daughter went to Stanford, and the textbook was accepted when they looked at the transfer. At Stanford, before they transfer the courses, they have to bring in the textbook if it's coming from a community college. They looked at the book. They said, yep, it's okay. So helped to validate me as the mother of this daughter. And we, at that point, Susan and I had already done a lot of coursework. So we had developed an online course to go with the book, and the online course was open, that anybody could look at the lesson plans, and had won a state award, the California Virtual Campus Award for outstanding or top course for the year in 2002. And we also had the very first set of community college iPod videos to go with any course in the world, and it was the first Apple hosted the iPod videos, and this was the first community college course. So it was the videos, and they had the captioning in them as well, so they could have them captioned. We did get a grant. CCC OER is funded by Hewlett Foundation right now. We had a grant, and it was to work on the development of OpenRed resources for community colleges internationally, but it's predominantly an American phenomenon, the community college. But we do have a Canadian college that's a member of the consortium. And so there are over 100 colleges that are involved. Along that, we met a delightful man, Bob Maxfield, who's on the board of Rice University. He went to Rice University, and then he went to Stanford for electrical engineering degree, and he founded a company called Rome, which is a very successful company. He then opened up, and now he's high level at Echelon. So in at least in California, these are very well-known companies. And he had an educational foundation. And he lives nearby. He met with the president or the chancellor of my college, Martha Cantor, who's now undersecretary of education for the country. And he came to us and he said, so what do you want so we can make this project work? And I said, what do you mean? He said, let me buy the copyright from you. And so Susan and I made an offer for the copyright, and he wrote us a check. And now he owns the copyright, and he transferred the copyright over to Rice University. So I don't want it to come across saying that, that I'm completely stupid going from earning, you know, dozens of thousands of dollars a year to saying, I don't need money, I have way too much money. But we really wanted and we believed in the OER, but we had a very successful product. And so at some point you have to decide how much of future money are you willing to give up if you really want to make something like this go. He really wanted to help Rice University being on the board of trustees. We wanted to help the students. And so it was a win-win situation and for all of us. Now, what ended up happening was that was really the only benefit that we thought we were going to get was a nice check. What ended up happening was the book went from being used pretty much predominantly in the Bay Area to being used at, now I think I was just told, over 50 universities worldwide. It went from, you know, only people who I knew the book, or our college or the local colleges who used it, to now have some sort of international recognition. It improved the text greatly. So what happened was, the text went online, get emails from people all over the world who say, I'm using your text, or I'm using your videos, and why don't you, blah, blah, blah. And we think, geez, I never thought about that. Let me do it. And we instantly can go in and change it if we want to. If we don't want to, we just say, thanks, that's a great idea. You know, you can derive copies and make your own textbook to go with it. We have a Creative Commons license, and feel free to do that. Professional development, I learned a lot. I feel that I've learned so much, almost that I should have paid for the education that I've gotten by learning about the process of student learning more. My interest has been a lot in adult learning theory, so when I was working on my PhD several years ago, I did a lot with adult learning theory, and I learned a lot more through the textbook, actually, through the process of working with connections with Rice University and getting it online. And another part that I hadn't thought about was that it started to bring in a lot of consulting. And so maybe the trade-off of the no future royalties you can consider being made up in consulting opportunities. I would assume that with, you said you wrote a book that's a certain niche, that either you were already considered the expert in the field or reinforced your expert in the field as an expert, right? But when, or maybe not. Am I sure, right? If you have this very specific.
There are no consulting opportunities in my town.
Okay. Well, I'll just say that this was an ad. Yeah. Well, actually, that's true. I got onto my first dissertation committee for, which I get no pay for, but yet that I consider that to be, I mean, for me, one of these just, you know, if you're not in math education, then this won't mean anything, but I'm on my first dissertation committee right now at San Francisco State. And I'm on this committee as an outside person, although I teach part-time there in their doctoral program. But the other outside person on the committee is Uri Treisman, who is considered one of the tops in the world in developmental math education. And so I'm already learning more by being on this committee. So for me, it's a real benefit to be on this committee. My first one, maybe I won't want to be on, what was Dr. Asante's 147 dissertation committees? But one is really interesting. So I just want to quickly go through what sort of the general benefits of open educational resources are. These are some of the, what I consider the general. The first one was always, the whole reason that this was started was to lower the cost. I've been involved with organizations that are bringing education to third world countries, and it's really very interesting to bring the education. There are people in Africa who are using my textbook, and there are also people in other countries who are using it. I got some emails from Latvia. I don't know the name of the school, but there's a school there that's using it. In America just alone, one of the interesting parts that came was that I got a slew of emails from a class that was using it in their AP high school statistics because it was free and they couldn't afford it. And they said they loved it because the teacher showed the videos. And the high school teacher didn't have either the qualifications or the background to teach AP statistics, but was, because he or she was the person assigned to teach it. And so they were using the videos and they were using the text. University of California has now included it as one of their approved textbooks for the Digital Learning Resource Network, which means that it now can be used in all California public schools for both AP statistics and the general probability statistics. So I don't know how other states are, but in California, you need to get a publisher approved, and then they do all of the content review. They've done that, so it's been approved for all of that. All of that brings me no money, but it really does do some more establishment for credibility on that part. And then the UC Office of the President worked with my textbook and a professor from UCLA, and they made a multimedia course, which is free for all California schools. And the reason they made that is that in the non-urban schools, you might have a school that might have three students ready to take AP statistics. And so they don't want to devote a teacher to it, and they don't have the materials. And you know, I grew up in Connecticut, which had an outstanding public school system. And my children went through the California school system, which is a very challenged system. We have wonderful universities, but our K-12 is quite challenged. So here are some of the other benefits. What I would say is that the feedback loop is incredible. We're able to update the book without going through major revisions. So for example, when it was going through the approval for the California Learning Resource Network to be used in the public schools, there were some certain things that are in the K-12 curriculum that aren't in ours. We could just add them in right there. We can update the problems when new data come out, so we don't need to be using old data in the homework questions and so on. And to me, that's a big advantage for doing that. I think this is pretty much what I've reviewed already about faculty being able to and teachers being able to reuse things and remix things. And I'll go a little bit about that in another slide, but what it does is it just allows people to take what they want and adapt. A lot of colleges do this by making custom textbooks. So if you have a publisher that has four or five different textbooks and you want a chapter from here and a chapter from there and a chapter from there, the publishers will let you do that. With the open learning and with the open licensing, you're able to do that without paying the fees for it. And I did want to just tell you that Connections got started actually when Richard Baraniak, who's an electrical engineering professor in the graduate department at Rice, he wanted to write another textbook. He wanted to write a textbook for a niche in his graduate students. He knew that it would bring no substantial income because of the fact that there were already lots of different textbooks in the field. This was for a very small population of graduate students, and he wanted it, and that's how they came up with the whole idea of the Connections Project, of the open source and the putting them online with open licensing. So here's just a little bit of customization. Faculty member Terry Teagarden uses our textbook. This is an easy customization type thing because she's actually doing it without changing content. We use a lot with the graphing calculators at my college, where I teach at San Francisco State part-time. We use Excel, so we can customize to use for Excel. She uses Minitab, so she's edited the labs and some of the things for Minitab, and then put her own site. Now, I wanted to just show you that now it has her name on it. Nobody's thinking that she's done scholarly work, but her students will see her name on it, and you'll see the attribution will go back to myself and Susan Dean, although in most cases, this must be before they fixed it, our names are linked, are hyperlinks, so you can see that it goes there. Here are just different options for just customizing for the technology, not even bothering for the content on here. I was going to, what was the other thing I was going to say? Oh, I was just going to talk a little bit more about one of the other parts that happened so far as customization. We originally assumed this is for an undergraduate statistics course that has intermediate algebra as the prerequisite, the non-calculus-based courses. So this is statistics. We're a service course to the social sciences for the most part, some of the business disciplines and so on, or for students who have to take a math class in order to get to transfer to get their four-year degree. One of the funniest things that happened to me was I got now with Facebook, we're connected to everybody in the world here. So I got an email and then friended on Facebook from one of our children's nannies from over 20 years ago who we had lost touch with because she's from Norway. And she went back to Norway, and we mailed letters, which is the way that people of our generation correspond, or at least corresponded. And then somewhere along the line, she moved to England. She got married. We lost addresses. She had ours. Every once in a while, I would get a Christmas card. But she moved to America and was in dental school program at Howard University. And she emailed one day to say that she was at school and the professor was using chapters from my textbook. I mean, how many Barbara Ilowskis are there? In the dental school pediatric residency program. And so, I mean, that was pretty cool, right? So it had a little bit of the cool factor. I got in touch with the professor at Howard. It's easy enough to find a professor. And he was telling me what parts he used. He then brought in other parts to be used in their dental hygienics program and some other things. So although this isn't establishing credibility in statistics or mathematics, it's many other disciplines that are using parts to it. The reason I think that that's valuable is I feel like I've learned a lot from things that I get for open licensing that bring into my own classroom. So there's so much that I've gotten out of open licensing from textbooks that are online, from some of the other systems that I say, oh, you know, I wish that I had thought of that first, but also this will really help my students. And so, you know, it's a share and share alike. Now, going back to what you said about not writing a textbook for free, I can tell you now, I won't write a textbook from scratch for free and put it up there. I'm not that altruistic or that generous. But what I would be willing to do, and I've seen this at other colleges, is a group of faculty get together and they say, let's put up some materials, and they may get a grant. And what always amazes me is how much academics will do for so little money. You know, you get a $1,000 grant and people are willing to work 300 hours to work on this, and the people, or get graduate students involved. And so I would be willing, and other people are willing to say, all right, let's get a group together, and together we'll come up with a set of materials for our students or all our courses. Now, it works, of course, much better at large schools like mine. We have 25,000 students at our community college, and with over 100 sections at 40 each of statistics per year, for example, and even more of the developmental classes and fewer of the calculus, you have quite a lot of students that are coming in for that. But I've seen that in other cases and in other disciplines as well, where people said, okay, I'll work on this part. There's now a group that's taking the textbook, and they've got volunteers over the world who are translating it into over 30 languages. And so my big interest was to get it into Spanish, because in California we have so many Spanish-speaking students. Well, a professor at University in Mexico who's been using the English version has a group of students, and with her over, or him, I'm not sure which, overseeing it to translate into Spanish. And also taking the references from the British measuring system to the metric system. So, anyways, that's what I had to say on this part. I'm happy to take questions. Yeah.
On the system that the book is on now.
Right, Rice Universities.
There was a button where they could buy a print book.
Right.
And do you make any money?
Well, the reason I don't make any money is because I sold the copyright. So the person, they do make money. Another part that's making money now is just this summer I'm piloting. We're on the quarter system. Finals ended Thursday night, and summer school starts Monday, and I'm teaching summer school. So I got involved. I don't know if you've heard of the WebAssign group. They came out of a graduate program in North Carolina, I think physics, if I remember. Well, now they do an online homework rating system, and they work with the major publishers, with Pearson, with Cengage, the major publishers with the textbooks to have the homework graded online. And so I've just started working with them. I introduced them to the connections folks, because obviously Hewlett Foundation and Carnegie Foundations don't want to be, they want these organizations to become sustainable, and sustainable without their funding every year. There's only so many years they'll give millions of dollars to all of these groups. So with the Coop Publishing, that's an outside publisher, they get some funding. With the WebAssign, again, I won't get royalties because of the fact that I sold the copyright. If I didn't sell the copyright, I would get royalties. But the royalties are going back to connections.
Okay.
on that part.
When you sold the copyright, it was then transferred to Rice. Could you have kept the copyright and still done all the transfer?
Oh, absolutely, with that, right. So absolutely.
Sell your copyright?
No, no, but I got the impression from the gentleman who was sitting next to you that there's no way anybody would do this without getting lots of money. But if I was to start again, you know, I feel like I'm a little bit old to write a whole textbook all over again, although listening to Dr. Asante, well, like, what do I have to complain about losing time? But I would be willing to work with a group of people in a consortium to do that, and at that point, I wouldn't be selling it. I would do that as professional development, contribution to the field, and that would go directly online. Some of the textbooks that are online now are textbooks that major publishers, for example, there's one textbook I know up there where the textbook was used in it was the adopted textbook for algebra in the Texas school system, the K-12 school system, for many, many years. He had written a second book that wasn't as well received, and that book he donated to, he had the copyright back because it was an out of print at this point, and he donated to there. Well, it's still a perfectly good pre-algebra book, and if I teach pre-algebra, I would use it instead of having the students purchase a $100 book and so on. Yeah. In fact, most of the books on the Rice site are books that have been completely donated. They weren't in that case. I mean, ours is sort of a special case because of the fact that it was already an established, accepted textbook. But I was it you who was starting to write a calculus book? No. Oh, I was talking to somebody here who was about to write a calculus book. And I wish her the best of luck in it, but there are so many highly established calculus books right now that I have no idea what level of success a brand new person coming in with a calculus book when there are dozens, I mean literally dozens and dozens out there, might be more successful to put it into open ed resources, get the use out and disseminate it more, and then be able to derive profit from consulting or some other way. You have any questions?
Not for me, but
right, and it doesn't mean to be, it doesn't need to be, and I would say it's probably not for anybody who's consistently earning $50,000 to $70,000 a year or more. But from what I've talked with authors, that's not the majority. Of people, the majority of people are earning under $10,000 a year of textbook authors. Maybe not in this organization, but nationally, certainly, the majority of faculty are not earning the big bucks. And so then the question comes with, you know, the balance. I'm thrilled that I've been able to help so many students stay in school. That's part of the reward, just like when you're teaching and the light bulb goes off, especially in my field, which I'm a statistician, but I teach a lot of developmental mathematics courses, and even in statistics, for some reason people think statistics is hard. I don't know why, but when they're struggling and the light bulb goes off, that's a lot of reward, and I know that's with lots of disciplines and lots of the reasons that we're in academia, and so this is just one more trade-off. Yeah. Do you have questions, comments? Kim, anything?
No, I wish I would have said the whole entire thing. I'm so busy.
I know, yeah. And Nicole, who keynote spoke yesterday, she and I have presented together nationally. So it's unfortunate that we missed each other because she's on the East Coast, I'm on the West. But she's coming specifically from the financial point of view of students. Hers is specifically that. My interest is the financial, but it turns out that pedagogically it's been a great bonus, and professionally, for me, it's been a tremendous bonus. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. Thanks for coming and sitting through. And Kim, I can give you a stack of handouts for anybody who's interested.
Yeah, I wouldn't see the turn on of being not interested. It's sometimes hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I hope you still
enjoyed it. Oh, no, I did. And I actually, you walked in at perfect timing. With your wife so involved, I'm assuming that they're funded by either Hewlett or Carnegie or somebody. Hewlett, which is funding CCCOER. So if you don't mind, on international broadcasting here, why is she involved? Besides the grant money comes in.
We've been married for 35 years, and one of the reasons is that we don't speak for the other person.
Okay, so you're not going to speak, and you're never willing to admit the pillow talk of why she's involved in Open. All right, fair enough. Okay, so it at least isn't the first time you've heard of it.
No, absolutely not. And that's the reason I'm here today is I'm very curious about the whole thing. I mean, I think from everything you said, that you have very good reasons to do what you did. It's been very rewarding for you. My personal circumstances are so different.
Right.
That, and one of them is the field that I work in. I'm an art historian.
Uh-huh.
But the main book that I write has over 1,200 reproductions of artworks.
Right, that are copyrighted, I assume.
The publisher spends an average of $500 a copy.
Right.
And it simply could not be made available for you to be economically suicidal for anyone to do so. It's just a non-starter.
Right, so that makes sense with all the copyrights involved with art history, that would make absolute sense. With statistics and mathematics, you know, the only part that somebody might consider to be copyrighted might be the normal tables. Well, I could recreate them myself, and the student tea tables, easy enough to recreate. Yeah, so I didn't have that issue of anything being copyrighted that wasn't our copyright.
How Open Licensing Improved Our Textbook and Our Careers is an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.